Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Please be seated. The first banner on this morning's calendar is the State of Minnesota versus Terry Lee Glazer. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments this morning. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments, and you may adjust the podium to suit your height. And of course, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, your honors. My name is Joe Tamburino. I represent the appellant, Tyler Glazer. Your honors, the primary issue in this case is the state's error, admitted error, whether it was intentional or unintentional, of commenting on my client's right not to testify at trial during closing arguments. The standard of review in this case for prosecutorial misconduct or error involving a substantial right that my client had in this case, the right to remain client, is a de novo review. And the court has to determine if it was harmless error.
Could you just wait one moment? We need to start the clock, please. All right, thank you.
That's okay. And the court has to determine if it was harmless error. But because it is such an important right, there is a further determination. Namely, that the court, in order to find that it's harmless error, it has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that this error was harmless. And the state's not going to be able to meet that burden, and it hasn't. This is reversible error, as we see under the Whitaker case, where the Whitaker case that both sides have cited and argued has a three-pronged approach. What is that? First, if the error, mentioning that my client didn't testify, is extensive. Second, if it infers guilt. And third, was there other evidence that showed my client was innocent? So let's go to the first standard. The first standard is extensive. And when this court looks at this standard, please keep in mind that the reason why this wasn't as extensive as it could have been is because I objected.
So it wasn't extensive.
It was extensive, but not as much as it could have been. It was extensive in the line of reasoning, Your Honor, because here's why. Starting on page 231 of the transcripts, the state starts to argue about the fifth degree criminal sexual conduct. On page 232, it goes through intent and about what's in the defendant's mind. It continues that on page 233, again, intent, focusing on that one element, which is what's in the defendant's mind. And then the state makes a choice to argue, well, look, you can't think about him not testifying, but there's other evidence. And then I objected. I couldn't find a case where, during closing argument, the state mentioned the defendant not testifying, the defendant objected immediately, and then on appeal they held that it was harmless. All of the cases are one of two forms. Either they didn't object and then they appeal under a plain error rule, that's not this case, or it was some type of court trial plea bargain where it was different scenarios, but none like this case.
Well, can I just stop you there? Because as I understand, it was about a two-sentence statement, right? And then you address, and then there's an objection.
Correct.
Correct? I mean, is that extensive?
That is extensive because there are two fundamental rights when you're in trial, the two most important rights when you're actually in a trial. One is the right not to testify. Two is the right to confront your accuser. Without respecting those two rights, you do not have a fair trial. You have to be able to confront your accuser, and you must be able to have that right not to testify. And why is it basically kryptonite for a prosecutor to comment on not to testify? Because that is so powerful for ordinary people. Everyone wants to hear from witnesses. Why isn't the defendant testifying? Now, I would ask the court.
How is it extensive when it's basically two sentences and then right after the state conceded the error and explained that it was worded poorly. So in that context, how can it be viewed as extensive?
Two answers to that. First, I want to take what the court said in the latter comments about, the state said it worded it poorly. There is no legal excuse of mistake or accident in this field, in this area, when there is prosecutorial error. There is no case that said if the prosecutor made a mistake or made an accident or was negligent or wished he or she didn't said something, gee, that's a legal excuse. So that's all irrelevant. That's not the case here. Now I'll answer the first part. The first part is this court should not hold it against counsel and client that I was actually paying attention and immediately objected when I heard something so objectionable. And it was extensive because I would point to the court, again, starting on pages 231, going on three pages, there is a buildup by the state of the defendant's intent. What is he doing? He's lurking about. What is in his mind? And it crescendos at the bottom of page 233 by the state saying, but he didn't testify. That's extensive. The court should not just look at, well, there was only 13 words. You have to look at...
It's important to understand what the words were that he said in context of the state needing... First of all, the state needs to prove intent. So that's perfectly fair game there. But second, you said that you've used the words that he didn't testify. You've used those words several times now. That's not what was stated. What was stated is, well, we didn't hear from him.
That's right.
And so I think it's important that we're consistent as to and clear as to what exactly was said. And in terms of Judge Cochran's comment about what was explained afterwards by the prosecutor, I think that does shed some light on this statement that it wasn't just, well, he didn't testify. In other words, it's consistent with the statement itself. It's not something that is just a flat-out blatant, look at that guy there. He never took the stand. He never testified. We never heard from him. We didn't. So, I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding how this is extensive. The statement and context of what it's made and the amount of words that were said there, it seems...
It's worse than saying he didn't testify, because testify is a legal term, to give testimony. What the state did was... But the state used words for even more common parlance. What the state said was even more powerful, but what I don't want to you to go back there and say is, quote, well, we didn't hear from him. We don't know what he was thinking. That is more common. When you talk about legalese like testimony and confrontation and objections, that's one thing. This is down to basics. It's saying, we didn't hear from him. That's very common parlance. And this phrase is basically one of those damn by faint praise. It's like, well, here's all the intent, but we didn't hear from him. Far be it from me to say that you should draw a negative inference on him not testifying or not coming up there.
But what about the curative instruction here? I mean, if the judge is telling the jury that he doesn't have to prove anything, it's all up to the state, and he has the right to remain silent, and he doesn't have to testify, isn't that sufficient to cure? I mean, because there's an assumption that the jury follows the court's instructions. Why wouldn't that be enough to take care of these two comments, which even the prosecutor admitted were not worded very well?
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, a curative instruction, regardless of how forceful it is, for something as fundamental as confrontation or remaining silent and not testifying, I don't see how that would ever work, especially with this high burden. Recall that in the cases Rust, Carradine, and Ramey, which both sides cite, Rust particularly cited by the state, there's a reversal in this case unless it's proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the statements were harmless. That's a high burden. And even the court itself, and I disagree with all due respect with the district court, but the court itself on page 235 said this was out of bounds of what is appropriate for closing argument or for any other argument. The court recognized how out of bounds it was. Now, the court did not go through a Whitaker analysis. It did not. It said it was out of bounds, and then as I was the trial attorney, as was Mr. Lofton for the state, as it was clear that I was going to lose that motion, of course I requested a curative instruction because I must do so to protect my client. So something as fundamental as this, an instruction is just not simply practically going to work, even when we do have the presumption that the jury would follow this. And here's why we know that, because I'll jump to the third prong. which is other evidence of innocence. And here's what's important. There's two things. One is the DNA. I questioned the DNA analyst. And there was a pretrial motion, which I did not prevail on before trial, where I wanted to mention that the two types of DNA that were found on the underwear were male DNA. And I was not allowed to do that, so the jury did not hear that. But I was allowed to question the expert that there was DNA found, but it wasn't from my client. So that proved, that goes toward innocence. The second is what we argued in the—
Does that go toward innocence, or is that just a lack of evidence to tie your client to—
It goes toward innocence because the victim herself stated that my client's fingers it never penetrated her underwear. Without being too graphic, his fingers never penetrated the underwear. The underwear was still on his fingers when she said he penetrated her.
But so, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't there testimony that one touch like that may not necessarily leave DNA?
That's correct, but it still goes to that you had DNA sample that was found there. The jury heard that. There was DNA found there, but it wasn't my client. That's exculpatory evidence. I mean, clearly, the state has the burden of proof. If you have DNA found on this box and it's not Joe Tamburino's, that goes to proof that Joe Tamburino didn't touch that box.
But you just did touch the box.
As an example.
Yeah.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that he didn't touch her or touch her underwear. It just means that there's not any physical evidence to prove that. I think that those are two different things.
It's not so different when you put it in the light of the state's burden of proof. At trial, the state has to prove it.
I understand that the state has to prove. That just means that they don't have that physical evidence to prove their case. It doesn't necessarily go to innocence.
Well, it doesn't necessarily go to guilt. I mean, the jury could do both ways. There's obviously nothing go to guilt necessarily.
Yeah, right. I agree with you on that. It doesn't prove the case either way. It doesn't prove innocence, but it doesn't prove guilt.
And in a criminal trial where they have the burden of proof to the higher standard, a toss-up goes to the defense. If it doesn't prove X and it doesn't prove Y, then you shouldn't use it to find guilt. But the second part of innocence is what we argued about the fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, where part of the definition is, if there is a touching of the buttocks over the clothing, that's not sexual contact. Now, my client didn't testify. And when that jury got this case, they would have to go through, per the instructions, and we assume that they read the instructions, that they would have to find that he did not touch her clothing over the butt area.
What evidence is there that he touched her clothing over the buttocks?
Her testimony that he touched her underwear, but she said it was in her vaginal area. That's right. My argument at closing argument, and my client didn't testify, but in my argument at closing argument, part of it was, is that the video showed, in my opinion, an argument that his fingers were going toward her buttocks, and there was clothing over the buttocks, as she testified, because she had underwear on, and there was not skin-to-skin contact.
But there was no testimony that he touched her buttocks, correct?
That's correct. This is why, Your Honor, you clued on the right point. There was no testimony, and the state said, we didn't hear from him. That's exactly right. That's the two points of the of evidence showing innocence or not guilty. That's the two points. And then I would like to go just to point two, which we passed over, which is the inference of guilt. Whitaker clearly says, is there an inference of guilt? Well, obviously there is in this case. To say that we didn't hear from somebody as important as a defendant, the state didn't do that to say, look, we didn't hear from defendants, so acquit him. Of course not. That's nonsensical. There is clearly an inference of guilt. Then I have less than 2 minutes. I would just like to briefly touch on the second point in our brief, which is the sex offender registration. What I would like to just highlight for the court is basically the Hawkes case, which both sides cite. And that is what the Supreme Court said in that case is the requirement of registration is to ensure predatory offenders cannot plead out of registration, plea bargaining. Not to vest prosecutors with unchecked authority, bless you, to require a defendant to register as sex offenders. What the Supreme Court said is the reason why we have this statute is so when you're in a case like ours, a fourth degree or a third degree and a fifth degree, they don't want to plead out so that, well, you plead to the fifth degree and we'll let the registration one go. That's not this case. This case had four complaints. February 6th started with a gross misdemeanor, fifth degree. February 7th upped it to a third degree. March 6th added language of surprise. We won the motion. They dismissed, the court dismissed third degree. State came back fourth time, April 17th, charging a different third degree coercion. Again, we challenged probable cause.
But in this case, I mean, we have a victim that is saying this is what occurred. And doesn't that in and of itself create enough probable cause to at least bring the complaint?
Not what, if it's unchallenged, yes, we challenged it. And not only did we challenge probable cause, the jury acquitted on that charge. This is outside.
Look at the acquittal. Why should we consider that? Because shouldn't we be looking at probable cause at the time a probable cause determination would be made?
Yes, but that was the fourth complaint. What the Supreme Court was very keen to, my time is up. Thank you.
You can finish your sentence.
Oh, what the Supreme Court was keenly interested in the Hawkins case is the power of the prosecution. And in this case, there were four complaints to get to probable cause, which the client, which the defendant was acquitted. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, Patrick Lofton, assistant county attorney for the state of Minnesota. Good morning. Your Honor, starting with the first issue, the prosecutor's comment in this case was harmless for several reasons. First and foremost.
Just to clarify the record, you're not disputing it was misconduct.
Your Honor, I'm going to not dispute that it was misconduct. I don't think that's a hill worth dying over. I didn't at trial, and I'm not going to now. However, I did cite that unpublished State versus Johnson case where this court held that a very similar comment was not error. And so I don't think it's worth it to dispute that it's error, but I think that case is still instructive in showing just how innocuous the error was. And to that point, Your Honor, it's interesting. I was thinking more about this before this argument this morning. The comment is actually consistent with the judge's instruction. So what the judge says to them right after the prosecutor, right after I made the comment, and what the judge says to them again before closing arguments is that you can't draw any inference from the fact that he didn't testify. Now, that's exactly what I told the jury. I said, what I don't want you to do is go back there and say, well, we didn't hear from him. And then before it was objected to, which was totally fine, I was going to say, so therefore we don't have evidence of intent. I was urging them not to do that. I was urging them to draw evidence of intent from the surrounding circumstances. And I believe that that's the same thing that the judge instructed them. And I think that cuts back on how egregious the error is. But yes, the short answer to your question, Judge Hooten, is that I do concede it was error in this case. It was inadvertent. And I do believe that the case law is pretty clear that the standard's going to be the same under Swanson. I cited Luteshaft for this proposition. They do make the distinction there between prosecutorial error and misconduct. And I think that's important because it, again, goes to just how egregious or not egregious it is if the prosecutor did not intend for it to be a direct comment on the failure to testify. It's interesting, too, I noticed one of the cases cited by defense, the older case from the Minnesota Supreme Court of State versus Race, R-A-C-E, 1986, there, and that's, you know, I believe pre-Swanson and pre sort of this line of cases that have emerged talking about whether we do the Karen two-part test or we go straight to harmless error. But interestingly, that case said, when the conduct is unintentional, the test we apply is to determine whether the statements likely played a substantial role in influencing the jury's decision. So I'm saying all that to say that I think it does matter somewhat as a threshold matter whether the comment was intentional.
Does it really matter whether it's intentional or not? Isn't really the important fact that a statement has been made that the jury heard. I mean, who cares? It's kind of ironic that we're talking about the intent of the prosecutor of the state when intent is the issue that's being discussed. But does it really matter what the prosecutor of the state's intent is?
Your Honor, I think it has to intuitively, and I think that's why this court in Lutschaff said the quote, there's a difference between prosecutorial misconduct and prosecutorial error, and the latter is a misstep of a type that all trial lawyers make from time to time. This court has recognized that in the frantic world of trial work, attorneys are going to make mistakes. Here, that took the form of an argument about the defendant's sexual intent and led into a misstatement about him not testifying. Judge Reyes, I do believe that ultimately you have to decide whether it was harmless. So in that regard, it doesn't matter that much. I just think as a threshold inquiry, the court can find there's less harm when the prosecutor clearly didn't mean to do it. But ultimately, it does have to be harmless, yes.
Sorry. Well, what about Mr. Tamburino's argument that the instruction to the jury was not curative because of the significance of the comment by the prosecutor or the statement about not hearing from the defendant?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, for that proposition, I would cite any number of the cases that say we presume that jurors follow the judge's instructions. This whole system really doesn't work without that presumption. I believe that by the time the closing arguments happened, Judge Anderson had instructed the jury five times that the state had the burden of proof. And it's interesting here, too, and this is why I threw the DeWald case into the brief. The DeWald case says that we can infer from a partial acquittal that the jury was not improperly influenced. It would be illogical in this case to think the jury was sitting there thinking, well, I'm going to acquit on third degree. I'm going to acquit on fifth degree as well. But, oh, wait, the prosecutor just reminded me that the defendant didn't testify, so I better acquit him. I better convict him of something. I don't think it's logical to think that the jury thought that because our case law is permeated with the notion that we're worried that juries are going to believe too much of what a prosecutor says or put too much weight into it. So when a prosecutor gets up there and makes a misstatement, the jury is sent out of the courtroom so that the defense, the state, and the judge can deal with the motion for a mistrial. They come back in, the prosecutor immediately, or first the judge instructs them that what the prosecutor said was wrong, the prosecutor immediately apologizes. I don't think that that's a set of circumstances that's going to lead a jury to say, well, we better convict him of something, so I'm going to give the prosecutor that gross misdemeanor. Rather, I think they'd be more inclined at that point to be like, well, the state really messed up here, and so I'm not going to give them anything. And I think that that also goes to prong three of Whitaker and how strong the evidence was in this case. So I'm saying all that to say, Judge Cochran, that I do believe Judge Anderson's instructions were sufficient, and I think that the verdict is proof of that, the partial verdict.
Do you agree that our standard of review here is whether the conduct is unusually serious so that we do have to do a reasonable, we have to find that that he would have been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt or that it was harmless?
Your Honor, I actually debated with whether to argue that we go to the unusually serious. I do think that this is a lesser comment on the failure to testify than we see in other cases. This isn't a case where the prosecutor is saying in closings, well, defense attorney just argued to you this, their theory of the case, but we don't have evidence of that. Again, I went through how this was inadvertent. So I think that for purposes of clarity in the law, especially since there have been a lot of cases talking about lately how we're not sure whether we're going to stick to that Karen two-part test and we kind of just go to the second prong, I think for clarity of the law, it's okay to say it was serious, even perhaps unusually serious, since it did reference the Fifth Amendment right of the defendant, and then go straight to harmless. Mr. Tamburino, for the appellant, did focus a lot on prong three of Whitaker, and so I want to speak a bit to that. Obviously, the video does show basically what the state and what the defense described in this case. The defendant's hand goes up for about 2 seconds. Common sense tells you that that's enough to accomplish penetration. It's certainly enough to accomplish sexual contact for purposes of the fifth degree. The DNA witness testified at trial that you may not have touched DNA in a circumstance such as that, and your honors have probably reviewed enough trial transcripts to know that that's essentially the state of DNA science. But I want to talk a little bit about Whitaker, because it's interesting. In one part in Whitaker, they talk about whether there was evidence that supported an acquittal, and then later they talk about whether the evidence supported an acquittal. And so in one passage, it seems that they're talking about whether there's any exculpatory evidence, any inference from which you could infer a defendant being innocent versus the evidence as a whole. And Mr. Tamburino is right. The lack of DNA is not exculpatory, but it goes towards the defendant's innocence. The short time frame from which the touching occurred goes towards the defendant's innocence. But what Whitaker means is the evidence as a whole. Because if the standard were any exculpatory evidence, any inference that the defendant might not have done it, well, then you might as well not have the harmless error test for such misconduct or error. It would be insurmountable.
Do you have to have all three factors before there can be a determination that it's reversible per se?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes, I think it has to be extensive. I think it has to stress that you can infer guilt from silence, and I think there has to be evidence of an acquittal. And interestingly, if you look at Whitaker, the facts in that case are tough for the state. I mean, this defendant's found running from the scene of a robbery, I think 30 minutes later, matching a jacket that's described by one of the victims. No one ever identifies him in court. There's no DNA tying him to the case. So in other words, if that evidence was sufficient for purposes of prong three in Whitaker, I think that the evidence here most certainly is. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I think you answered it, yes.
I'm going to move. Sorry, go ahead.
Just briefly, even if the three prongs of the per se test aren't satisfied, could it still be found to not be harmless error based on the record as a whole?
It could, Your Honor. Obviously, we're urging for the court not to find that, but it could. You have to satisfy Whitaker before you get into harmless error land. And then that's where you look at the frequency of the remarks, which, again, is kind of duplicative of the Whitaker standard, but I think the cases outline this. The frequency of the remarks, the strength of the state's evidence, and whether the judge instructed. And here the judge did promptly instruct the jury, as the record shows. I'm going to move to the second issue, if that's all right, but I'm happy to answer further questions about the first issue. Second issue, registration. It's very clear that a person convicted of an offense arising out of a registrable offense has to register. Lopez made it clear, and then this court's decision in Hacos, a quick follow-up to that one, made it clear that that means it has to be supported by probable cause. It's interesting. I also struggled with this in the brief. At what point does the court look at whether there's probable cause? Again, as I argued, and I think it's clear, there's probable cause at all points in this case, from where it's alleged in the complaint to the end of the trial where a full record has been made. So wherever you look, I do believe there's probable cause. But I think Lopez and Hacos offer kind of different perspectives on that, because in Lopez, they're looking at it at the time of the charging decision, and then they note that the victim in that case saying essentially he was kidnapped is enough, even though the prosecution later dismissed that charge. And then in Hacos, the prosecutor or the state in that case kind of alleged summarily in conclusory language that, and this is the fact that would underline the felony charge, the fourth degree, that the defendant would have been aware of the victim's mental incapacity for purposes of fourth degree criminal sexual conduct. And this court held in that case that that was enough at that stage, that within the four corners of the complaint, the prosecutor made a summary conclusory statement, and that was enough. Here, it's in the four corners of the complaint, and it's based on a statement made by the victim to the prosecutor, as opposed to the prosecutor making an assumption or an inference in a complaint, which I believe they are entitled to do in certain circumstances. So, in other words, probable cause in this case, as Judge Hooten, you alluded to, is intertwined with KF's credibility, and KF's credibility is a determination that's already been made and cannot be revisited. So really the only way appellant can win on this issue is if, as a matter of law, these facts can't constitute third-degree criminal sexual conduct, and that's where the DLK case comes into play. And I believe that's a 1986 Minnesota Supreme Court case, and it held that force that accompanies sexual contact can constitute a felony charge, and it doesn't have to be force that accomplishes sexual contact, despite that word being in the actual statute. I don't think it's a far leap to apply that principle to penetration, because surely force that accompanies sexual contact being a felony, force that accompanies penetration should be as well.
Counsel, I have a question for you about one of the allegations in the complaint. There was an allegation that the victim suffered pain that lasted until the next day.
Yes.
What was the basis for that allegation?
That was based on the first prosecutor in the case, who was not me, had a phone conversation with the victim. I forget on what exact date, but it's in the record. He actually testified at trial, and she told him that on the phone conversation with the victim advocate before he amended the complaint to include that language to then charge the third-degree force and coercion.
Okay, and did she say that she had pain that lasted until the next day, or just that she had pain? That's the point I'm unclear on.
I wasn't there for the phone conversation myself. I forgot exactly what he testified to, but it was the witness Dan Allard in the case, and I don't have the full transcript in front of me. I apologize, but I believe he testified that she said she had pain that lasted until the next day. I could be wrong about that, but that the statement of pain coming from the complaint was certainly based on a conversation that he had with her over the phone before adding that charge.
Can I ask you, can you point us to a case where there's been the type of misconduct that took place here, and there was an objection and a curative instruction, and the court found that it was a reversible error? And
Your Honor, no, I didn't find one with exactly those parameters. The cases where and I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Do you want me to? You can finish your answer.
The cases the defense or the appellant cites in this matter are State versus Porter, State versus Fields, State versus Holte, and State versus Race. I can tell you, with Porter and Fields, the language is so much more egregious in this case. It involves the sort of inflaming the passions of the jury, more direct references. In State versus Field, the defendant directly commented that the defendant failed to call a witness to support his testimony. That's just completely different. So in terms of finding a case with this similar comment where there was reversal, no, Your Honor, I couldn't. And again, for what it's worth, as an unpublished case, I'd point you to that State versus Johnson case. That was the most similar substantive-wise language to the comment that I made that I could find.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just some quick points. First, the state, and it made this argument in its brief, is making the argument that, look, all I did was comment in terms of not this person testifying because, well, the judge already said that in the instructions, and all I'm showing is to tell the jury, you can't consider that. Not permitted. Not permitted at all. If the district court's decision is upheld in this case, it will be guaranteed that from this point on, prosecutors will use this case to say, look, it was allowed in this case. Prosecutor can say, by golly, the judge mentions all over the place in the jury instructions that you can't draw any negative inference from a defendant not testifying. That's all I'm doing, Your Honor, in my closing argument.
Is that really going to happen, though? Because, one, we've already got the Johnson case, which is very, very similar, albeit unpublished, so it's not binding. But, two, the district court did say it was error. So it's not, if a prosecutor does go down that path, they do risk having that decision overturned.
And they will use this case to show that it was harmless. All I did was I just commented on what the judge said in the jury instructions. Don't do a negative inference on him not testifying.
Right, but each case has to be evaluated on the particular facts.
That's right, and that's why I could not find a case with these facts where it was objected to immediately, it was about the right to remain silent, and it was held as harmless. And when the court asked about other cases, obviously we all know that district court opinions aren't published opinions as this court's opinions are or as the Supreme Court. There, as practitioners, we've all had experience with mistrials. They're not published. We have no idea what trials have occurred throughout the state where something has been either mistake or by accident said, and there was a mistrial.
But doesn't the Whitaker factors avoid the result? I mean, it indicates that we've got to go through those factors in order to find it's reversible, per se. It's not just the fact that that the comment occurs is sufficient to do a reversal. We've got to go through those factors, right?
That's correct.
Isn't that the protection, that you would need in order,
No.
Your argument seems to fly in the face of the protections afforded by the Whitaker case.
It would not lead the protection because, Your Honor, right now, we never see prosecutors using that argument by saying, the judge said, don't do a negative inference on him not testifying. That's all I'm doing. It just doesn't happen. And even with the protection of Whitaker, we will have cases where that is argued in closing argument, and it will be found to be harmless. This is the point of not mentioning the testifying. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, it seems to me that here we have actually the prosecutor even on appeal and at the time of trial saying this is inadvertent, I shouldn't have done it, but I agree it shouldn't have been said. So that in and of itself, you're asking us to infer that every other prosecutor, even though they know that everyone agrees in this case that it's prosecutorial misconduct, will in the future commit this misconduct based on this decision. And I guess that's really asking us to speculate, I think.
Well, there's so much speculation that I'm not asking the court to do. I'm asking the court to look at what was said. There's complete speculation as to what was the jury's mind, which is why I don't think this has been proven to be harmless. But one more issue before I have less than a minute is the Johnson case that Judge Reyes, you mentioned. The Johnson case is a great example of a defense attorney being asleep at the wheel. A Johnson case, that defense attorney never objected when the prosecutor asked the police officer, the investigator, did you get a statement from defendant? No. Why not? Well, he had counsel. No objection. And then the prosecutor at closing argument comments on that. The prosecutor was simply commenting on something that came into evidence. Yes, it should have been objected. It was ridiculous that defense attorney did not object. But the prosecutor in that case, he was in a better light than even in this case, because in that case, he was literally arguing about something that came into evidence without objection. And it was about not giving a statement to an officer, not to the degree at all about not testifying at trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. It was very well briefed and argued. We will take the matter under advisement.